and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing outrage at the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy of separating children from their immigrant parents at the southern border who have made a dangerous journey to the U.S. from Central America seeking political asylum. We'll first speak with Dr. Julie Linton, a pediatrician in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, who is the co-chair of the American Academy of Pediatrics Immigrants Health Special Interest Group and the lead author of the 2017 American Academy of Pediatrics Policy on Detention of Immigrant Children. She joins us to discuss the medical issues involved in ripping young children away from their mothers in terms of the consequences for mental health and childhood development. We will also examine the effects of detention on the physical health of these immigrant children, since many of these makeshift facilities have been hidden from the public and the press, as plans are underway to create tent cities on the grounds of federal prisons, some in the desert, where temperatures soar above 100 degrees. Then we'll look further into the medical aspects of childhood trauma, the infliction of which has become national policy as a result of the cynical pandering by Trump, Sessions, Kelly, and Miller to their anti-immigrant base, with Trump tweeting out an outrageous charge that the Democrats don't care about crime and want illegal immigrants like MS-13 to pour into and infest our country because they are seen as potential voters. Dr. Dawn Garzon-Marx, a clinical professor at the Washington State University College of Nursing and president of the National Association of Pediatric Nurse Practitioners, joins us to discuss how these traumatized infants and children crying out for their mothers cannot be comforted by those holding them in detention, adding insult to the injury being done to them by Trump in the name of the American people. Then finally, we will speak with Ken Bensinger, a journalist with The Wall Street Journal, The Los Angeles Times, and BuzzFeed News, whose latest book just out is Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal. With the World Cup underway in Russia, we will discuss Ken's article at The New York Times, Did Russia Steal the World Cup?, and investigate the corrupt deal which got Russia the World Cup in the first place, and the role of Christopher Steele of the infamous Steele dossier in bringing down the criminal reign of FIFA boss Sepp Blatter. And joining us now is Dr. Julie Linton, who is a pediatrician in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and the co-chair of the American Academy of Pediatrics Immigrants Health Special Interest Group. And she's the lead author of the 2017 American Academy of Pediatrics Policy on Detention of Immigrant Children. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Julie Linton.
Thank you so much for having me tonight.
And as we speak, the president's on Capitol Hill meeting with the Republicans. There are two rival bills, one from Congressman Goodlatte, one from Speaker Paul Ryan. Nancy Pelosi said neither bills have a prayer. The president himself, before he went on to Capitol Hill, said he wants to make changes, so that'll even further complicate what appears to be a complicated situation. And on top of that, the leader of the Senate, the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, has made it pretty clear that his members aren't interested in either of these bills. So what's going on at a political level here, in your opinion, Dr. Linton?
Well, I think what's most important is that no law is needed to end family separation, and no law forces the United States government to separate families. We know that family separation and detention of children cause irreparable harm to children.
So is this just sort of theatrics then? Is that what's happening here? I mean, in other words, the president keeps blaming this on the Democrats, but what you're saying is that he can solve this with the stroke of a pen, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'll leave it to political commentators and legislators to determine the nuances of what the legislation will look like. But there is no law needed to end this policy, and there is no law forcing the United States government to separate families. We know that highly stressful experiences like family separation can cause irreparable harm to children's developing brains. And that is what is happening with policies that separate families systematically and put children and families in detention.
Well, just in touching on the Senate, a dozen GOP senators led by Senator Orrin Hatch have sent a letter to Attorney General Jeff Sessions asking him to halt the separation of immigrant families while Congress works out legislation. So at least it would seem that some effort's being made there at a congressional level, at least from the Senate. So we'll wait and see. But your organization, I believe the head of your organization, Dr. Colleen Kraft, visited one of these detention facilities where these young children are kept. Is that right?
That is correct, yes. She was there in April.
Uh-huh. And she said that what was particularly troubling was that the children that were crying could not be comforted, that whoever these people are that are taking care of these children, they're not able to physically comfort the children?
Well, I've heard a lot of different interpretations of that, and I think what I continue to hold in mind is that regardless of whether or not they're able to comfort the children want to be comforted by their parents. When children are faced with highly stressful experiences like family separation and detention, they rely on the buffering and protective support of adult relationships that they know, like their parents. And the comfort of someone they don't know can only go so far.
So what is your organization calling for then specifically here? Because this is a situation that's just started. I think only been less than 2 months and about 2,000 kids have been separated and is supposed to be a deterrent. It's, the Attorney General calls it a zero-tolerance policy meant to deter parents from bringing their children, but that's not working from what I understand. People keep coming because the countries that they're escaping from are essentially unlivable. Their lives are in danger, so they take this incredibly risky trip up through Mexico, being preyed upon by all kinds of criminals, and they finally get to the border and the kids get ripped away from them. So that's the situation. It doesn't seem like the deterrent part of it, which is what Jeff Sessions uses to justify what he's doing, isn't necessarily working.
Yeah, I think the crux of this is that children do not immigrate. They flee. And they're seeking safe haven in our country, and they're seeking humanitarian protection. And what's happening is not consistent with the values of compassion, dignity, and respect that Americans hold so dear, but it's also not consistent with their legal ability, as I understand it, to request asylum. What I think is what we're asking for as the American Academy of Pediatrics is an end to systematic family separation and truly a prioritization of the health and well-being of children at every step of the immigration process, from the moment they reach our borders until they are in communities.
And the American Academy of Pediatrics is also urging the U.S. House of Representatives to reject the Border Security and Immigration Reform Act. So
that is correct.
Just to sort of finalize our discussion on what's going on the Hill this evening with the president, not that we really have much details at this point. And again, I'm speaking with Julie Linton, MD, who is a pediatrician in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and the co-chair of the American Academy of Pediatrics Immigrant Health Special Interest Group. She's the lead author of the 2017 American Academy of Pediatrics Policy on Detention of Criminal Children. So let's walk through the 2017 study. What is the policy that you've urged?
Well, in that policy statement, we specifically ask that at each step of the process, children are treated with dignity, compassion, and respect. We prioritize that no child, regardless of their country of origin, should ever be separated from a parent unless they are at risk at the hand of that parent. That children should never be in detention, and that children and families, the majority of families, despite how they're being painted, are not a risk to our society, and they should be released to community members and family members not held in detention.
And is this just, I mentioned that the deterrent part of it's not working, but because the numbers are growing and these facilities are springing up kind of ad hoc way and contracts are being let, rather rapidly, and the one that was the press were given access to was a converted Walmart in Texas. But there's also talk of tent cities on federal detention facilities, in fact, in federal prisons. Is that something that troubles you too?
I think that it is so difficult right now to know exactly what the true plans will be. But what I can say is no matter what is decided, there is no evidence that any amount of time in detention of any form, whether it is a processing center that looks like a warehouse with cage-like fencing that I've been inside myself as well, or whether it is a tent city, there's no amount of time that's safe for children. And even short periods of time in detention can cause psychological trauma and long-term mental health risks for children. I think the conditions in the current processing centers, which is initially where children and families are processed and where some of these separations are taking place, the conditions in those facilities are absolutely egregious. And I can only imagine what facilities might look like that are constructed quickly. I think each of these steps needs to have the best interest of the child as a priority. They're children.
But how did this happen? It wasn't the policy up until Attorney General Sessions made it the policy. And even though the president himself denies that it's his policy and blames it on the Democrats, it's pretty clear that Jeff Sessions announced it. And prior to that, the Chief of Staff, General Kelly, said this policy was coming. And he specifically said, we're doing this as a deterrent. So their justification is that the parents are being arrested, even though they go into immigration court and it's only a misdemeanor. Is there any logic to what they're doing? Can it be in any way, anything they've said so far, does it make any sense to you? Because it doesn't make any sense to me.
So as a parent and as a pediatrician, but particularly in this case, I'll speak to you as a parent. If I had to choose between the immediate risk to my children in the conditions that children and families on a daily basis are telling me they're subject to in their countries of origin and are fleeing violence, fleeing abject poverty, and fleeing direct threats to their lives. If I were a parent, I can't tell you what I would do. And so to treat people that are seeking humanitarian protection as criminals is wrong. So I don't think it's a deterrent, because I think when you have no choice, it's impossible to be violating anything when there is no choice. Beyond that, I think the way that we are currently treating children and families who are seeking humanitarian protection is threatening to the short and long-term health of the children. It is disrupting their brain architecture, and it is a violation of the values of this country that I thought we had been founded on.
Well, it is heart-wrenching to see, and it's awful that it's happening in the name of you and me and everybody that we know. And I think a lot of people are upset by this. All the former first ladies have come out against it. And there does seem to be, I think a latest poll from CNN said 2/3 of Americans are against it. How do you see the tide turning here? What do you think it's going to take to sort of shame the president into stopping what he's doing, even though he's blaming it on the Democrats?
Well, I don't know that I can predict the future, but what I can say is that as a pediatrician, I can't look at a child and know that that child is living in constant stress with levels of cortisol flying through their body in a constant state of alert because they have been taken from a parent or they've been placed in conditions of detention that are threatening their short and long-term health. And I hope that everyone out there that is a father, a sister, a brother, a grandparent, a human, can imagine what it would be like for a child that they love to be in a condition of constant stress and how they might feel. And hopefully with that kind of humanity, we can all take a step back and recognize that we as a country do not want to be causing intentional harm to children.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, I saw a really disturbing piece on television the other day about what's happening on the border with Texas and Nuevo Laredo on the Mexican side, which is a completely lawless town where over the years hundreds of people have disappeared. And what's happening is that the people coming from Central America, from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, fleeing violence there, get to that border crossing in Nuevo Laredo, and they're basically told that the queue for asylum is too long and they have to wait more in Nuevo Laredo. And apparently Nuevo Laredo is run by drug cartels, and many of these families have already been kidnapped, have already been shaken down and forced to borrow money from relatives to ransom themselves back. Then they cross the bridge into the United States. Then they're turned around and go back to the mercy of the drug cartels in Nuevo Laredo. I mean, it's a shocking report, but it's one of many, from what I understand.
I've heard similar stories, and I think there's a number of people that have incredible ideas about how that we can all work together across various sides of the aisle to come up with solutions that prioritize the health and well-being of all children, regardless of where they or their parents were born, and that we, once children arrive at our border and are in the custody of the United States of America, that we can be prioritizing their health and well-being and treating them all with dignity, compassion, and respect.
Well, Dr. Julia Litt, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Julia Litton, who is a pediatrician in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and the co-chair of the American Academy of Pediatrics Immigrant Health Special Interest Group. And she's the lead author of the 2017 American Academy of Pediatrics Policy on Detention of Immigrant Children. We're going to take a brief station break and back, looking further into the medical aspects of childhood trauma, the infliction of which has become the national policy of the Trump administration.
I am a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world alone. There's no sickness, toil or danger in that bright land to which I go. I'm going there to see my mother.
Time to send someone away. Got my back covered. Said, how you been all led astray? Come, let's count its ups. They lead you to the race, but no one's asking.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Dr. Dawn Garzon-Marx, a clinical professor at the Washington State University College of Nursing and president of the National Association of Pediatric Nurse Practitioners, with more than 24 years' experience in primary care, behavioral and mental health, and urgent convenient care. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Dawn Garzon-Marx.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, thank you. I wish it was under better circumstances, because what we're talking about amounts to a national policy of child abuse, and all of us are shamed by the actions of our government at the moment, both nationally and internationally. And your organization written that traumatic life experience in childhood, especially those that involve loss of a caregiver or parent, cause lifelong risk for cardiovascular and mental health disease. So could you elaborate on this and tell us about the study that you've done?
Absolutely. So the work that this is based on is the Adverse Childhood Experiences research that was done in the late 1990s. And what we know scientifically and we have seen replicated in multiple studies is that children who experience very traumatic experiences can have what is called toxic stress. And children who experience toxic stress, it does increase lifelong risk of heart disease. It can increase cancer rates. It increases obesity rates. And it can certainly contribute to mental health issues. curiously, we're also noticing in a number of studies, including some recent research that just came out this month, that some of those effects might actually affect future generations. And the thought is that these traumatic experiences turn on genes that are present, and that once those genes are turned on, that may be one of the reasons why we see this increased incidence in disease in the child's lifespan. But we now see that adults who've had traumatic experiences in childhood have children that have higher rates of certain chronic diseases. And so that might be that mechanism through which this, in a sense, trauma is passed down to future generations.
Well, I'm a grandparent of a 2.5-year-old, and my mother and my granddaughter were just staying with me for a few days ago. And the little one was asleep in her car seat, and her mother went out for a little bit, and I was babysitting, and she woke up, and there was no mother there. And even though she knows me, it was painful listening to her wail and trying to comfort her. And, of course, her mother showed up shortly thereafter. But it was a painful experience for me. I mean, and I'm her grandfather. So I can only imagine what it's like for a child to wake up and realize the only person you've known all your life is gone.
Well, and I think we have to, when we're specifically speaking about the immigrant children, there are a number of issues. So there are language issues. The culture may be different. Many of these children have literally walked thousands of miles escaping or fleeing from situations in their native countries that were considered to be bad enough by a parent that they thought, I'd rather take the risk walking across this desert than take the risk of having my child be here. So just that very migration can be very traumatic for the child. So then if they then show up and maybe their nutrition hasn't been optimal, they're dealing with seeing their parent being afraid or traumatized, and then they're placed in a situation surrounded by people that they don't know, removed from this caregiver that they rely on, with potential language barriers. And there have been rules that have been passed by well-meaning individuals who I'm sure made the decision to do so to protect children from bad advances on the part of bad adults, but unable to hug a child or let the child sit on their lap or have any sort of physical comfort, they're able to attempt to verbally help these children. But if that language barrier is there, those children don't even have that. So this is an unusual circumstance where there are all of these very traumatic things that come together. And I hear you. I've got two kids myself. And as a mom, you know, when my children were very upset, it was absolutely gut-wrenching. This traumatic stress is obviously a whole other level that goes beyond kind of the normal childhood anxieties and fears that come into place. And these children are particularly vulnerable. And so we have to be very careful on how we treat them, that we don't further traumatize them through the process.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Dawn Garzon-Marx, who is a clinical professor at the Washington State University College of Nursing, and she's the president of the National Association of Pediatric Nurse Practitioners with more than 24 years' experience in primary care, behavioral and mental health, and urgent convenient care. So there is an audio clip that has made its way out of one of these facilities where the children are being detained. And it's quite heartbreaking. The language is all in Spanish because these kids only speak Spanish. And there is a Border Patrol agent who speaks Spanish, essentially making fun of the plight of these children and more or less saying, which is a part of the kind of stuff that you hear on Fox News, that this is all a liberal plot, that they basically, kids are being coached, their parents are coaching them to come here and lie their way into the United States. And, of course, the president himself just tweeted out today, Democrats are the problem. They don't care about crime, and they want illegal immigrants, no matter how bad they may be, to pour into and infest our country like MS-13. They can't win on their terrible policies, so they view them as potential voters. So in other words, our president is saying that the Democrats want gang members to come in here, the worst people to come in here, so that they'll vote. It's pretty preposterous, and frankly, the rebuttals from the Democrats are pretty pathetic in the face of those kind of vicious insults. So it's a pretty dismal situation politically, but it seems like it's almost like a lot of people in the world of Fox News and on the far right and Trump's base in this country actually get a great deal of pleasure out of seeing the anguish expressed by people like you and me. Laura Ingraham was basically saying, oh, these kids are just at summer camp, you know, more or less saying that a bunch of these whining liberals are just completely phony, literally making fun of compassion in the face of this heartless treatment.
Well, I mean, I can't speak to what happens in the minds of politicians because, you know, I'm just a normal person and a nurse practitioner who happens to be a mom and is passionate about kids. I can tell you from my experience, I grew up in Miami in the 1970s and 80s and was there during the time that we had Cuban immigrants and Haitian immigrants arriving on the shores during the Marielle Boatless and during the Papa Doc Duvalier times. And so I have cared for and seen the condition of many of our immigrants who are literally in the middle of the night fleeing their homes and coming here. And I know that the conditions of the individuals that we've seen is that they need care and compassion when they arrive. You know, I think what we need to do as Americans who feel that this may not be representative of how we want to see children treated is this is our opportunity to have honest conversations with our representatives, with our policymakers, because they work for us, right? So they're there because we elected them, because we put them in office. And this is our time to say, with all of the scientific evidence that we have, we know that further traumatizing these children is basically putting them at risk for serious health outcomes in this in their lives, as well as potentially to any of their offspring. So I can't speak to why any talking head on one side of the aisle or another comes to the conclusions that they do. I can only just tell you that what we know from scientific evidence is that these are very dangerous conditions for these children to be in. And even our own government has standards of trauma-informed care and how we're supposed to care for children who've experienced trauma. And the cornerstone of that is to make sure that we don't further victimize them and further traumatize them while we're caring for them.
Well, let's play the clip that's been made available of these children in detention. It's all in Spanish, needless to say. And of course, Ann Coulter said that these kids were essentially, the crying kids are child actors. But I think you can tell from just the audio that these kids aren't acting. And one of the little kids is asking for her aunt. She's been told how to get in touch with her aunt. And the male voice, again in Spanish, is a U.S. Border Patrol officer, is more or less saying this is all orchestrated. You know, kids are the orchestra, and so where's the conductor is pretty much what he said. Let's just play that clip.
Bueno, aquí tenemos una orquesta.
And again, that is some audio from these young children in detention. I find it pretty heart-wrenching. What's your response to this, Dr. Dawn Gazon, Marx?
So I can tell you that as a pediatric nurse practitioner, children's suffering has been my life's passion. Preventing it helping them recover from it. And that our organization, the National Association of Pediatric Nurse Practitioners, as well as the American Academy of Pediatrics, other nursing groups, have come out clearly with clear stated concerns about how we're further traumatizing these children. The lack of human response to any individual who's suffering, and this is me speaking, this isn't beyond, you know, this is me as an individual, not in speaking for anyone else, is very difficult for me to understand, because I believe that, personally believe that compassion is an important part of who we are as human beings. What we need to do as organizations is to then help inform the individuals about exactly what's going on and what we know are the results of these types of adverse experiences.
So in terms of influencing, of course, the president is meeting with the Congress this evening in Washington. There's a couple of bills up, and he's already said in advance of these meetings that he wants to make changes. So it's very difficult to know what is going to come from this. And the Senate's made it pretty clear that they're not particularly interested in voting on any of these House bills. So it seems as that at this point that what's going on politically is kind of a sideshow. It's sort of meaningless theater. So what would your advice be to members of the audience who are outraged by what's happening to the treatment of these children and want to get the attention of their lawmakers to deal with this man-made disaster?
Well, I think our role as individual citizens is always to pick up the phone, call our legislative offices, let them know that we're concerned about these issues. You know, time and time again, I've seen politicians be swayed by feedback from people who live in their districts. So certainly I would advocate that we pick up the phone and that we call and we share our perspectives with our legislators. I think as families and as community members, you know, there are organizations that are working with these children that we can help support. And then as parents and as people like yourself, who's a grandfather, when children ask about these questions, when they see things on TV and they have questions about what's happening, you know, remember that we're talking to children, that children are kids first. And so, you know, we want to, I don't know that talking about the politics and it is necessarily something that a young child should be exposed to. But certainly what most young children want to know is that they're safe and that they're heard and that there is someone who loves and cares them and protects them, and that it's a wonderful opportunity to have discussions with our children about what our own individual family values are around this topic. Because children learn from our example. They learn more from what we do than from what we say. And so I think those of us who are concerned, it really falls on our shoulders to actively do something other than just getting into yet another rant with someone on social media and speaking up with the people that are in positions to change this and let them know that we don't find this practice to be acceptable. Or if we feel that it's a practice that should continue, that's something that should be discussed as well, too.
Well, it's apparently, though, not just the psychological mental state of these children being traumatized by being ripped from their parents' arms at the border. Physically, we don't know a lot about these shelters and the conditions. Only one former Walmart was made open to the press, and it was largely housing, well, entirely housing young boys, I think, up to the age of 15 or 16. I think most of them were at least 10. We haven't seen, we only had the audio that I played a little while ago of one of the facilities holding the younger kids. But now they're talking about tent cities. And in the middle of Texas desert, it's got to be pretty horrible physically, doesn't it? I mean, are you concerned not just with the mental health, but also the physical health of these children?
So absolutely. It's over 100 degrees. It's in the desert. You know, are these children going to be kept from being overheated? Will they have sufficient amounts of fluid so that they're not dehydrated? These are very important questions. And again, get back to this issue, are we re-traumatizing the children even further? And the people who would say, you know, he's 16 years old, a 16-year-old is still a child. They're still growing. They're still developing. They're actually at a particularly vulnerable time period because their brain is remodeling itself and kind of rewiring itself to optimize the way that it functions. And so even 16-year-olds, we have to remember, are not adults. They're children. They still have fears. They still have concerns. They may not have that complex understanding that we have. And again, I would just ask if you would want to be in that sort of a situation. If you were tired, frightened, potentially dehydrated, exposed to illness during the time that you traveled these thousands of miles, would you want to be in a tent? And what types of care and services that you would feel that are needed? And these kids' physical needs have to be met. We cannot cause further trauma and fear by separating them from the adult that they confide in. And anyone who's ever been ill or in a stressful situation knows that their ability to process during that time is even more difficult. And absolutely, there are physical dangers that are inherent to housing someone outside in the heat in the desert.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Dawn Garzón-Marx, you mentioned earlier that the caregivers, and we're not even sure who they are and how qualified they are, that are taking care of these kids, they are forbidden from actually comforting the kids physically, even touching them. And there are obviously reasons for that. But we heard the clip of the Border Patrol person being rather callous, suggesting all these crying kids were being orchestrated. But the little kid that's asking for her to get in touch with her aunt, that person cannot be comforted when she finds out that nothing's being done physically. I mean, you can't hug her, in other words.
Well, and that's my understanding, is that, you know, because of fears of bad types of people coming in and abusing the children, that very similar to what we teach our teachers or what we teach our healthcare providers, is that we have to be very careful about physical space with children, and that we don't come into their physical space in a way that could be seen as being threatening or abusive in any way, shape, or form. It is my understanding from the reports that I have read that many individuals who are working with these children have, in fact, been informed that they can try to verbally console them, but that they shouldn't have direct physical contact. And I think the photo that you alluded to earlier was of the child who was standing and crying, and someone was talking to them, and again, not being present at the time and only seeing the picture, it would seem that that picture did support that practice of not physically interacting with the child.
Well, Dr. Dawn Garzón-Marx, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for your time. I am very happy to be here.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Dawn Garzón-Marx, who is a clinical professor at the Washington State University College of Nursing and president of the National Association of Pediatric Nurse Practitioners, with more than 24 years experience in primary care, behavioral and mental health, and urgent convenient care. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the corrupt deal that Russia made in order to get the World Cup now underway in Russia, and the role of Christopher Steele in bringing down the criminal reign of the FIFA boss Sepp Blatter. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ken Bensinger, who has been a journalist for more than 20 years, writing for The Wall Street Journal, The Los Angeles Times, and since 2014 for BuzzFeed News as a member of its investigations team. A finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in National Reporting, his latest book just out is Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal. And he has an article at the New York Times, Did Russia Steal the World Cup? Welcome to Background Briefing, Ken Bensinger.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So, Ken, obviously I want to get into this, talk about Steele, of the infamous Steele dossier and his role in bringing down Sepp Blatter, the corrupt leader of FIFA. But what I find extraordinary is that my understanding is that tomorrow, Sepp Blatter, even though he's been banned for 8 years from the sport of soccer, he's showing up at the World Cup in Moscow as a guest of Russian President Vladimir Putin to watch Wednesday's match between Portugal and Morocco, and then the match between Brazil and Costa Rica on Friday. So how do you think that's going to play, and how do you think the guy that's been put in charge of FIFA, Infantino, how's he going to feel about having Blatter there sitting with Putin?
Yeah, it's a pretty remarkable thing. I mean, we'd heard this was coming for some time. Putin originally said he was going to extend the invitation last fall, or Blatter said he was going to be invited. But actually seeing Blatter get off the plane today and show up in Moscow was quite surprising, and really reminded us of sort of who's in charge of this whole party, and it's not FIFA. Less than a week ago, last Thursday, Putin was sitting with Infantino, the new president, in the presidential box along with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, and that was sort of how one might expect the first match to go. But to now have him sitting on with a guy who was disgraced and pushed out of the sport under criminal investigation and banned from all soccer activities originally 8 years, although on a technicality it was reduced to 6, but nevertheless out of the sport, is really a bit thumbing his nose at the very least at FIFA and kind of all the institutions that have been scrutinizing Russia. It's Putin saying, this is my party, I'm going to do it my way, and I don't care.
Well, could it also be the fact that Putin is the boss of bosses, the capo di capo? He regulates organized crime. It's a kleptocracy. And he has these cutouts, these oligarchs that do his political bidding. And essentially, he runs it like a mafia boss. The only problem is that we've never had the combination of national security and organized crime before. We've never had the combination of the mafia and nuclear weapons, but that's a subject for another conversation. But the long and the short of it is, isn't this the behavior of a crime boss? I don't care what you think. This buddy helped me out, and we made a deal, and I'm sticking with the deal, and, screw you. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that there's a lot of parallels there. There's a lot of much smarter people than I studying this who know all about it, but who've made those parallels as well, that this is about that. It's about those kind of relationships and about that organization that looks like a mafia. And loyalty is incredibly important. And if Blatter was loyal to Putin, and then Putin is going to not be afraid at all to single him out and make a point of showing the world that. I mean, this is, Putin is not someone who shies away from being public about certain things. So it wouldn't be surprising at all, the message from that being, if you do things the way I like it, then we'll get along just fine and you shouldn't worry. So that message certainly comes through. I think there's no question. I think if you're Infantino, as you asked earlier, how does it feel? I think it can't feel anything except for undermining and a reminder that you aren't the one in charge. And so that's an interesting drama going on as well.
So let's just get through a sort of brief sketch of what happened in the role of Christopher Steele, which enters the picture because the Brits were bidding for the World Cup and against Russia and others. They hired the former MI6 Russian specialist Christopher Steele, to look into the, I guess, into the Russian bid, which I think the Brits didn't think had a prayer, because they have such a powerful history with soccer, and they thought they were a shoo-in. But what they didn't count on was the enormous corruption of Blatter, FIFA, and Putin. So walk us through, if you will, the steps that brought Steele in and how it later sort of morphed into something else.
Yeah, that's right. So the World Cup we're seeing now was decided, the site of where it was going to be was decided back in December 2010. And in the year and a half leading up to that, various countries were competing for the privilege. And you had Russia, obviously, and you had England. And then there was also Portugal and Spain were presenting a combined bid, as was Belgium and Holland and the Netherlands together in a bid. But everyone who's sort of following it knew there was really two contenders, and it was England and Russia. And Russia was a contender only because it was, I guess, people thought Russia was important, not because they had the technical merits to host. And they weren't really serious next to England, which everyone figured would walk away with it. England invented the game. England had hosted once before, and it was a successful tournament. They had the best professional league in the world, and they had these glorious stadiums and all the airports, highways, hotels, trains, every sort of infrastructure thing you could desire were already in place. And so it seemed that England was going to be a shoo-in. And England didn't take it very seriously at first, but they ultimately hired some experts to help them with their bid, which meant learning everything they could about the FIFA voters and also everything they could about their rivals. And one of the people they hired, as you mentioned, was Christopher Steele. Well, Steele had been an MI6 officer for many years and had only recently retired from active service and opened a private corporate research firm where he used his intelligence gathering skills for clients. And this client, the English bid, wanted him to find out about Russia. And he began digging up information about Russia and rather quickly discovered things that suggested to him things were not as they appeared. Russia had been courting FIFA voters, and also it looked like maybe finding ways to either bribe them or give them benefits in kind that would push their vote one way or the other. They'd been meeting with other countries with votes and offering sort of oil deals and sorts of things that would seem to be not great deals, but ones that would make sense if there was a vote swap implicit in it. And Russia was also employing some of its oligarchs to help with the messaging on that. It was unusual because some of the ones involved were people who kept a very low profile and were never seen doing bidding for anybody. The one that really comes to mind is a guy by the name of Roman Abramovich, who extraordinarily wealthy guy who made his money beside Putin in the 90s and then went to London and bought the Chelsea soccer club, football club in London, which is one of the most storied and valuable clubs in the world. This guy is starting to be spotted at FIFA events, glad handling with these voters. And Chris Steele sees all this, and it raises a big red flag for him, and he tells the English bid. But he also takes an extra step, which is to call up an FBI agent that he knows and to ask that FBI agent if he might want to come to London to hear about what Russia's up to and about what's going on at FIFA. And that wasn't the first conversation between Steele and this FBI agent, but it was the beginning of the FIFA case. It led the agent, who didn't really know anything about FIFA, to go back to New York, where he was based, find a sympathetic prosecutor, and convince that prosecutor to open the case. So the case, of course, ends up being enormously successful, which I'm happy to talk about, but also what you have there is establishing the bonds of trust between the FBI and Christopher Steele. And as we all know, that becomes incredibly important 6 years down the road when Steele finishes his now famous dossier about alleged collusion between Trump and Russia to undermine U.S. democracy. His prior relationship with the FBI meant that when he comes to them with this document, he's a known entity. He's someone they trust, and they're going to take this seriously as opposed to just some wacko with some document they don't know what it is. He was vetted for already, and that was critical because otherwise the FBI might not have taken a hard look at it.
Well, but isn't it pretty unusual that this crime boss, Sepp Blatter, who had the kind of patina of all of that sort of bourgeois respectability of a Swiss businessman, but clearly was just unbelievably corrupt, and people were under it for the longest time. There was a reporter I spoke to from the BBC who was banned from all of FIFA's press conferences because he kept asking uncomfortable questions. So it seemed like, it, in an odd and ironic way, it took the Americans to break this case open and to nail FIFA. And this, of course, is not a country famous for its soccer. Soccer is making inroads through youth soccer, et cetera, and getting more popular, but it's not really an American game like it is a European or international game.
Well, that's just it, right? I mean, in a funny way, for those who are familiar with how important soccer is in the rest of the world, it kind of took a country that didn't care that much for the sport to break this open. I think what people like Steele and people elsewhere, the journalist you mentioned is Andrew Jennings, discovered is that most countries just love the sport too much to go after it. There was too much political pushback. Anytime anyone wanted to look into it in a criminal level, there was pushback from politicians, from fans, from numerous different stakeholders that made it really hard to go forward. And there just is very little history of any kind of criminal investigation of the sport. And what's out there, these things end up going nowhere. The Swiss investigated corruption once in the mid-2000s. That case ended with no FIFA officials being indicted, even though people who had paid bribes admitted to paying bribes and named names. The Brits never really opened a case. The Brazilians had been, prosecutors had been referred cases a few times, but refused to take them. There just was no political will anywhere to do this. And it led to a culture of impunity at FIFA that just got more and more exaggerated over time. So along comes this FBI agent. He doesn't know FIFA from a proverbial hole in the wall, but he does know a good case when he sees it. He is attracted to this, as is the prosecutor he's working with. He's attracted the chance to do a big, ambitious money laundering case that involves Russians and oligarchs and crossing international lines. And there's no one within the DOJ who's going to tell him not to, because no one really cares that much about soccer. They, at the beginning, in fact, they didn't even think it was a very important case. They assigned what was effectively a brand new agent, a very green young case agent, to run the case. And it was his first or second ever case that he ran. So the FBI agent I mentioned was a supervisor, but to do the day-to-day management of the case, they put in a kid who was not even 30 years old. Gives you an indication that they just didn't think it was a front burner thing at the time.
But it was being run through the Southern District of New York, was it, the investigation?
No, the Eastern District across Eastern the district. River in Brooklyn. Yeah.
Oh, I see. Of course, the trial was in Brooklyn in the federal
Correct.
Court. So, didn't Blatter, in effect, get away with it? I mean, they never really managed to nail him. He certainly didn't do any jail time, did he?
He was never indicted by the U.S. The closest he's come to trouble. I mean, he's not happy. I mean, he's lost. He thought he'd have that job for at least another 4 years, if not another 8 years. So he lost that job. And if you ever meet Blatter, which I have had the experience of doing twice, you see this as a man whose own personal identity is completely wrapped up in being the FIFA sort of kingpin, and doesn't really have a sense of himself beyond being a FIFA guy. So this is a guy who's lost all the sort of defining things about his life. On top of that, he is under investigation by the Swiss attorney general now, which is sort of has been cowed into opening its own investigations after the U.S. case, as have several other countries. France and Germany, even Australia, have opened up investigations in the wake of the U.S. case. So he's under investigation for what's called disloyal payments, the idea that he might have paid bribes with FIFA's money. He's, as we talked about earlier, banned from the sport and kind of a persona non grata in the soccer world. Now, it's true, but he's going to Moscow now and get to watch the sport with Putin, but he's still not someone who's ever welcomed back in FIFA headquarters. And so he's disgraced, but you're right. It's unlikely he'll ever see the inside of a jail.
So obviously the deal for Russia to get the World Cup involved some amount of corruption, which is Putin is not unfamiliar with. In fact, it's his governing principle. But it's also, I think, pretty pervasive in the Middle East. And the next one, it's in the Gulf, isn't it? In 120-degree temperatures. It never made any sense. That had to be some kind of under-the-table deal as well, did it not? The following World Cup after Russia?
It's in Qatar. That's right. It's in 2022, and that was a case where the United States and a few other countries were going up against Qatar. The vote took place in the same day, but it was a separate vote from the 2018 World Cup that Russia won. And this one was one that, kind of like the Russia situation, everyone assumed the U.S. would win. It was the most technically qualified, economically qualified, and every level seemed like the obvious choice, but instead it went to Qatar. And there have been a lot of accusations that this was, that the fix was in. A colleague of mine at BuzzFeed, where I work, in her prior position, wrote an entire book on this with a Times of London journalist, where they had gotten access to the Qatar Soccer Association's president's hard drive and had read all of emails and clearly showed that he was paying out money all over the world. Now, there's some debate whether the money he was paying was to get the World Cup vote or separately to get votes for him because he ran for FIFA president soon thereafter. So it's not crystal clear whether the bribes were paid so Qatar would have the World Cup or whether he could be president, but it's clear the bribes are being paid. And Qatar has worked furiously to preserve the World Cup since then, despite a dismal human rights record, and despite the fact that, as you mentioned, the weather is totally inappropriate for a World Cup. The way that was resolved was that FIFA, under a lot of pressure, finally moved the date of the World Cup. So the 2022 World Cup is currently scheduled for December of 2022. Every other World Cup in history has been in June and July. This is extremely unpopular in the world of pro soccer because all the professional leagues in every country, except for the U.S., play a schedule that has matches in December. And so it's going to be disrupting all of their very lucrative game schedules. So it's, no one's happy about it. And it still continues to be a really controversial choice.
Well, I think it shows you that these under-the-table deals and all this kickback and corrupt payments is really have basically stolen this great popular game that I think it's the most popular game in the planet. So it's really always been a crying shame that such a tawdry bunch of crooks have hijacked the great sport of soccer. Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Ken Bensinger, who has been a journalist for more than 20 years, writing for The Wall Street Journal, The Los Angeles Times, and since 2014 for BuzzFeed News as a member of its investigations team, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in National Reporting. His latest book just out is Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal. And he has an article at The New York Times, Did Russia Steal the World Cup? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Larivalette. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.